Hey guys, thank you for listening to the Zach Scriven Podcast. The Zach Scriven Podcast is sponsored by Anchor. Anchor is the easiest way to make a podcast. It gives you everything you need right in one place for free to publish your podcast across Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, all the podcasting place. You can record, edit, and even add sponsorships and earn money from your podcast. Really easy to get started. Go to anchor.fm or download the Anchor app to get started. And thank you, Anchor, for sponsoring the Zach Scriven Podcast. Thanks for listening.
I think it's a mindset that, you know, I think we're coming to an understanding that, you know, if we step back for a second, Industrial 4.0 is, you know, what it really is that you can get the Wikipedia answer. It's all about IoT. The way I look at it is that it's a shift in the architecture of how data is interchanged. And that's, to me, one of the biggest impacts in the organization.
Benoit. Is that French or?
Yes, I'm from South Louisiana.
Awesome. Yeah. And so what brings you out to Woodlands?
What brings me out to the Woodlands?
Yeah.
Long story. So my career started out in automation when I first got out of school. I went to go work for Martin Marietta Manned Space Systems. We made the external tank for the space shuttle.
Oh, nice.
So I was
the red ones, or oh yeah,
the orange one.
The orange one, yeah. And then the other ones are solid rocket boosters.
Right, the solid rocket boosters, the SRBs.
Okay.
So
that's pretty cool.
Right out of school, I was doing automation for manufacturing of those tanks, and a lot of it's the ancillary systems manufacturing, and that's where I got into everything, DCSs, PLCs, you know, you name it, and got that bug bit in the automation. And long story short, my career expanded from working for an engineering firm where we did greenfield chemical plants, startups, Smuckers, so food, petrochem, a lot of pharmaceutical, that type of thing, and then got into software, which, as you know, kind of leads, and back then that's where the money was software, not engineering. So had my own company doing that for a while, and then eventually went through several companies, and then joined a national Microsoft consulting firm, where that's where I got into more of IT. So I started off my career as OT, then went into IT, and then got into IT with this, basically it's a large Microsoft consulting firm, and then started working with Microsoft's IoT. And so because I had that control background, you know, I helped start that IoT practice there. And then I really wanted to get with more of with a company, instead of coming from the IoT world to get into IoT, I wanted to start from the other way, OT, and then bring IT in. And so that's why I'm here today. So I kind of went full circle on my career.
Wow.
Now I'm with a system integrator with controls, but I have that background of both the IT and the OIT in the OT side, which is what, you know, IoT brought
right.
together, you know. And so I thought it was a perfect, you know, fit for my career, and so really excited about that. So now I'm able to talk on kind of both sides of that convergence, if you will.
And CSC Icon is really kind of driving that OT up towards the IT world.
Right, exactly. And so since I understand that IT world and I can speak that language as both, I get to bridge that gap. I help bridge that gap, which I think is what one of the values that I bring to the table.
Yeah, and so why don't you share, I want to actually talk about those space shuttle tanks here in a second, but
I got some stories there.
You want to share just a little bit about what your like kind of function is within CSE?
Sure. I'm a practice manager here, and you know, I manage a couple of practices. One of them being the IoT practice, as well as custom software development.
So
I have a strong background in custom development. So all of our clients, they always need something custom built, that type of thing, and so I kind of bring more of the latest technologies to the table there.
So almost like a little bit of like software development manager, or
right.
like a little bit of Scrum, or what kind of
development? Well, so I'm used to a very agile shop, and so I'm flexible and adapted to what the client needs. I'm not going to push a particular
methodology
down to them. But I am finding that a lot of companies are still, they're agile, or they claim they're agile. And so I mean, easily adapt, but I've been exposed to so many methodologies over my life that I can feel, you know, understand how they're coming from and adapt to that. But a lot of times we're just doing little one-off services here and there,
right.
A lot of data integration type services. Then we did another really app I want to talk to you later about that I think you'll find it very interesting with Industry 4.0 that
awesome.
Was custom developed as well.
So a lot of system integrators out there are wanting to get into Industry 4.0. They're wanting to, you know, move up the stack, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're maybe started out cutting their teeth on PLC automation mm-hmm. programs or, you know, HMI panels. How do they get, like, why has CSC-ICON been so successful in pushing that up through the enterprise and actually working on enterprise projects where they may not even be automation customers?
I think it's a mindset that, you know, I think we're coming to an understanding that, you know, if we step back for a second, Industrial 4.0 is, you know, what it really is, and you can get the Wikipedia answer. It's all about IoT. The way I look at it is that it's a shift in the architecture of how data is interchanged. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, one of the biggest impacts in the organization. So typically, you'll typically see, like, I've got controllers out in the field, then I go through some SCADA, then the SCADA system then feeds a historian, and then the historian's job is to feed the IT systems, where it's, you know, it's material handling, whether it's inventory management, that type of thing, right? And so now you've got this change management nightmare, because
everything's
daisy chained. You've got different owners for each system. They want to change the SCADA for their use, and then they break everything down the line. IoT's done is introduced this has kind of pushed the concept, which it could have happened before, which is, for instance, using MQTT, having a hub or a bus architecture, where now everybody has their constraint and their diminished concerns is isolated, so that now data is published, anyone can publish to this hub, and then we have the consumers. So if we talk about that same model again, now if the SCADA package changes, it doesn't affect anybody but the SCADA owner.
Right.
And the historian changes.
It's
right?
more like you kind of opt in.
Yeah, opt in. Ideally, it's a plug and play, right? So you want to be able to add different consumers, different producers, right? Mm. And so what's happening right now, a lot of people are experimenting with ML, right?
Right.
And they're really experimenting with it. So if, let's say, you have a vendor that says, hey, we can optimize XYZ with some ML. If I had that model, I usually just plug into the hub. You consume whatever data you want. Nobody needs to know about it. It can run in parallel.
Right.
You know, kind of a thing. And then it's gone. It also gives me the ability to upgrade my systems with less of impact to the whole entire enterprise. You know, and so to me, that's a big change. And it's a struggle right now, because the vendors that play in this area are not necessarily ready yet for that. We're starting to see that. They see it. They're trying to get there, trying to support certain standards like SparkPlug B on MQTT. You know, vendors are hurrying up, trying to get to there to be able to support things like that, those standards to help the interoperability there,
yeah.
right? But, you know, this isn't a great panacea in utopian thing, but the problem you have when you have that component is change management. So how do you manage the change from a standpoint of, you know, who owns the definition of the metadata around that I/O?
Right.
Right. So you've got to be able to, so that other people can consume it, right? In the traditional daisy chain world, some people said, well, okay, well, the SCADA system owned that, you know, and so that's where you get the definition of what this I/O point is. Or you can get into the historian.
Right.
Now you have to have that. And then specifically with CSE-ICON's customers, we're talking about oil and gas production customers, which, if you think about it, they're constantly having to change because they're constantly spinning up wells.
Right.
Compared to a factory floor where they're doing slight modifications, so change management's not a deal. But we're talking about, I have a client that's adding wells every day.
Right.
You know, so how do you manage that? How do you manage that change? Now I've got to go all these systems, you know. A big hurdle is we talk about edge devices and IoT, is how do we manage that? I have a client that really doesn't even care about getting the actual data. That's the easy part. It's how do I remotely manage these devices? How do I provision them? How do I coordinate? I've got a new device out there. I've got to update my SCADA. I've got to update all these systems, right?
Right.
So one of the custom applications that I've written for a customer is that instead of making the changes in the system, you go to one system that automates the configuration of the system. So
it's a system of systems.
Yes. And so therefore you go to this application, this web app essentially, and you say, okay, I need to provision a new well. You get feed from your material management system, you know, your inventory management system, that kind of thing. You feed it, you fill it all in, and then the system then goes and automates and configures your SCADA system for you, configures your historian, configures your devices.
Yeah. And now is this kind of pre-MQTT era, or is this...
Yeah, it doesn't have to be MQTT.
Because this could be done with just regular OPC UA devices.
In fact, we initially did it as a kind of the OPC daisy chain type of thing. And so it helps with, you know, I think it helps them be prepared to go to this new model a little bit easier, right? Because it becomes a massive data management problem. You know, what do I own?
Right.
You know, what is it that I own? I have this well. It has these flow meters, these pumps on it, you know, down the road. This IO, you know, what's there? And what do you call it? I mean, the big problem is the name. The name of it in one system could be a name of a different system.
Yeah.
It still works. Somebody's got to map that, right? And then if you look at it from just within an organization, there's lack of standardization. So when we look at you know, inorganic growth, when you got companies buying other assets, okay, they do it one way. This one does another way. Mm-hmm. This does another way. And because the way their business is designed is that such you're responsible for your P&L, you're responsible for the P&L, but the enterprise itself suffers because they're the ones that have to aggregate this data that now is all disparate. Right. So then it becomes more of a standardization problem than anything.
Yeah.
You know, and so being able to help with that, you're not going to, you know, of course, migrate to this new world overnight.
Right.
And that's the hard part. How do you transition? And so you need systems to help you transition and get a handle on what you've got.
Right.
And help you standardize and help you, you know, point out that, you know, before no one really looked at the fact that this asset's doing it differently. This why? Well, just because they happen to like it that way. There's not a business reason why that. That's just, you know, I like to call my things this kind of a
thing. Yeah. So, and then like alarming and stuff becomes a nightmare too.
Yeah, I mean you end up with anytime you have to aggregate that data, and as you know, when you get to the what's the most important thing is your financial system, right? I've got to know what my revenue, I've got to know what I'm producing, right? And so you end up having manual processes involved and those type of things. So, you know, this one client we're helping with kind of experiment, doing the lab, getting some MQTT in there to sort of see what devices are ready.
And how are customers being receptive to that technology?
I think they're you know, you can see some skepticism because I'm starting to see, you know, they've got all this infrastructure out there. They've got these devices out there. They've got radios out there, and they're trying to figure out a way. Well, can I use my existing capital expenditure? Is it just a software upgrade? You know, there's some radios that you can go ahead and they're running Linux. They can support containers, so I can throw another container on there. They'll push out MQTT,
right.
You know, data, and boom. That's a very cost effective solution where you got other devices that don't. But then you got the architecture of using edge devices,
right?
That you can use to handle offload all that when you still use your existing infrastructure beyond that. You know, so. But yeah, it's definitely. I'm excited about it. I'm an architecture guy. I like to see the being able to have that ideal. You always try to move towards the ideal, right? But you know you're not going to get there overnight.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but you need to have a plan.
Because then at some point, it's like as new assets are coming online every day, you can't just say, all right, now everything's MQTT and
right, exactly. It's not going to happen overnight. So you've got to be able to support a hybrid model. Yeah. Right, and so being able to architect a way where this is ideal where we want to go, but keep in mind, like for instance, sometimes so I had a client evaluate a vendor that said that they remotely manage the edge. Okay, well this was going to replace one of their key components that they have, systems that they have. So my question was, is that, okay, that's great. It can manage its own devices, but what about other devices that it doesn't manufacture? Mm-hmm. How are you going to live in a, because you're not going to replace everything, nor can you, because they don't make every device controller, you know, an RTU that maybe you need a specific flow meter, flow cal device.
This
out
is
there.
The argument for open source versus a unified closed source.
Exactly. And you know, and I just came back from a conference last week and I saw some vendors that are still producing closed data. I'm talking to communication that's proprietary still, you know, that kind of a thing. And so,
interesting.
Yeah, so it's really, you know, exciting from that standpoint. I think change management is a big, big deal that a lot of people kind of overlook. So how do I manage the system over time?
Yeah, there's a change management company that kind of focuses in automation. I think their name is like MDM or some acronym like that, something like, yeah. But when you said master data management, there's another LinkedIn content creator, Scott Taylor, who I actually got a chance to meet in New York, that he's all about master data.
And that's an IT concept, right? You know, that comes from the IT. How do you, you know, IT brought the big data to this picture, right? Initially, they were managing that, right? And what IoT does is it's generating all this big data now, you know, and that's what's causing the convergence there, right?
Well, so I think that's actually the OT that's generating the big data.
Well, yeah, but
because it's more like the process data.
Right. Yeah, the process data is definitely. But I think before even we had IoT, we still had big data. But the big data, they were still getting it from other ways and things like that.
Transactions for Amazon would be big data.
Exactly.
But that's still master data.
Right, exactly. So yeah, all your transaction, high volume transactional systems are. But what exploded it was now I can put a sensor on anything.
Yeah.
Right. And so therefore, what am I going to do with this data? And what is the value of collecting that data and having those analytics on that data and making them actionable?
Because,
right, that's the goal, is to have actionable analytics.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So you said you worked on the tanks for, and those are, it's half liquid oxygen, half liquid hydrogen?
Yeah, so you have a LOX tanks in a hydrogen tank. And it's basically two tanks, and the then there's, it's made up of three parts. There's the intertank, which is basically a ring that kind of holds the two tanks together, and then there's a strut that goes across, which is what the SRBs mount to.
Okay.
And then they have mounts on the bottom tank to mount the space shuttle.
Okay.
It's very, very interesting. A 43-acre facility, air conditioned facility at the time. And this was, you know, I date myself. This was a long time ago, but when the space shuttle was right after the first disaster, I had joined, and so we ended
up in the Challenger.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so what happened was production slowed down, right, because they weren't doing as many launches, and we slowed down to the point where if we go any slower, we would stop.
Right.
So we had to stockpile these things. So we had storage facilities, and eventually they started, you know, putting them in the aisleways of where production was and things like that.
Almost like a 737 MAX.
Yeah, exactly. So they're kind of doing that, you know, and everything. And I always had this funny story. And, you know, pardon all the safety people out there in the world. But, you know, we're young engineers riding around on little golf carts, you know, and everything. And then they have these tanks stored, and they have to have a guard there to watch. And there's flammable decals on it. Well, we know that the tank is pressurized with nitrogen. We're like, it's not flammable. They have to have these, you know, placards. But what people don't realize is the reason why they're guarded is because that insulation on the outside is called SOFI, spray on foam insulation. It's orange. You can stick your finger in it. An irate employee could throw a pin at it, that kind of thing, and then they'd have to reinspect and that kind of a thing, you know. And so, you know, like one of the things we used to do is, one of the things I did was I would automate some of the cleaning facilities. So the tanks would go in these cells on their vertical. It's actually the same facility they made the boosters for the Saturn V rockets.
Wow.
So they're really tall. And so they would bring these tanks in, and because they're storing hydrogen and oxygen, they have to be completely clean because they will react with any hydrocarbon. You can't have a hair in it.
Wow.
So we would have these what they call a Christmas tree. They would lower down and they would open up.
Okay. Almost like a car wash?
Yeah, but imagine going inside of a tank, opening up with all these, and they have jets, and it would spin, and it would clean all these chemicals. And
so you worked on that?
In the automation for that. So I'm a young kid.
What did you program that in?
So that was done with, we had PLCs, and then I used
these PLC 5s or Monicons?
They're PLC 3s and 5s, okay. And I, in fact, replaced some bubble core memory.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was pretty fun. We all fought over who's going to get the bubble core memory cards. but then I used Intellution package back in those days.
That's GE?
Intellution back in Boston. They were original, I can't remember.
That's their own company.
Yeah, their own company.
What was the product's name?
I forgot what it was called. It's so long ago. We're talking late 80s here. Mm. But we used that. That I remember we had these industrial NEMA 4 enclosures for the PC where we had the – this was back 80, 86 days, man, when you had the QMM memory extension.
So not yet Windows 3?
We had RAM cards. No, this was DOS. Wow. So we have cards in there for extra storage for RAM and all. But we would do that and – so I would do like a lot of closed loop control. And so for instance, for that facility, the tanks have to be pressurized at all times. So you can't even go neutral pressure on them or they'll collapse. So they always have to be under pressure.
That's where they're getting a lot of the rigidity from.
Right. And so we would have the cell, if you will, that they would go in. And so I had two HVAC loops. So I had one that pressurized the environment, then I had another one that would go inside the cell. So I always had to make sure the pressure in the tank was less than greater than the pressure outside the tank.
So you don't crush the tank.
So here I am trying to tune these PID loops.
Mm. Okay. It's because you didn't get like a normally open, normally closed kind of switch flip there.
The thing is that air is compressible. Okay. Mm. And when you're talking about huge amounts of air you're moving, it's a very laggy system. Mm. So trying to tune these PID loops, and so I had two cascading because I had one cannot lever let the other one get right.
Okay.
So I spent literally all night because I was never going to overshoot. So it was overly damped, if you're, you remember PID. So going to overshoot because, I mean, that's millions of dollars that were trash. Okay. Wow. And so when I got back, when I finally finished it, my mentor at the time was laughing because that took me all night to do it. I said, well, I'm not going to ruin this tank, that kind of a deal. But, yeah, you kind of learn on the job. But I got some interesting jobs there.
That's cool.
We had a lot of diversity. We had a wastewater treatment facility there.
Yeah.
So we had to do that. I did, everything from the CAD for running the conduit,
That's an interesting interesting story. It's probably good that you switched jobs though, because now I imagine you might have gone.
Changed,
but obviously
not
making any more of those tanks anymore.
No, they're definitely not. Well, they switched. That facility went to work for start making some other things too. Yeah. So at the time they would, we had a good time.
You ever miss the aerospace industry?
No. I don't miss it. Believe it or not, after a while it gets kind of old. It gets kind of, same thing over again.
I think
again.
One of the things that I actually initially went to Cal Poly Pomona to study aerospace, and I think one of the things that kind of was turning me off to it was that of how massive these projects are, that you end up working on such a small subsystem.
Yeah, and so I wasn't actually on, designing the space shuttle. I was more of a facilities engineer, doing all the support and the automation to support that. Right. But,
that's what I love about system integration, though, is that you actually get to touch all of the systems.
Right, and so one of the things that was interesting is I was comparing my job to people that I graduated from college with and say, hey, what are you working on? Well, I went to go work for McDonnell Douglas working on some fighter.
Right.
And I'm like, that sounds like an awesome job. He goes, well, my job is I have to make this black box. They tell me what the inputs are. I gotta figure out how to make the outputs be this, and they won't tell me what it's for.
Hmm.
And where I'm actually doing hands-on, when they actually do the construction of the job, I get to go out there and do the startup. So I love startups. I love doing the startups. I mean, that was the funnest part, because you get to be an engineer and apply what you've learned, and actually see it work. Now, and then on the flip side, I've done hydrogen cyanide and sodium cyanide plants, where you got to wear a gas mask, and if things go wrong, you die.
Wow.
And so... you know, we did automation. I've done a lot of automation in that kind of area, you know, and so you get to learn testing, you know, you get to learn unit testing, you get to learn not to assume anything, you get to, you have to, you verify every wire that goes, lands into that PLC, for instance. You don't assume it's connected to the right thing before you do your startup, right? So you learn systems that way, and you get your hands dirty.
So do you think it's better to learn in a like a critical environment like that, or like my background being water treatment? Well, actually, not even water treatment, but also like just water production, like pumping the wells and maintaining. You know, it's
I don't think it matters, because in the end of the day, it's really the same. You know, thing. You're controlling valves if you're doing flow control, you're understanding PID loops, type of things. So you're understanding that real-time control. You understand.
There's just a lot less at stake, because if you overflow a reservoir,
you still have fault tolerances. You learn things, simple things like what's the difference between a high level and a high level. You know, I mean, people don't understand that, a low level, depending on, you know, for a tank, you know, those kind of things. So you learn that. But it also teaches. It's very interesting, because what I learned, and then when I transitioned to software and how software is tested, and I joke around with people, I said, look, y'all don't know anything about testing, because the stuff I tested, if it was wrong, people would die. But you know what I'm saying?
So, oh, interesting, huh?
You know, but you can apply a lot of that. A lot of it just apply. It just works that way. You know, you can really apply. I've got, you know, tons of stories that I could tell you just, you know, through that. I've automated everything from a Kevlar plant, which was really fun, mixing, just do mixing, complicated mixings and ratios, and making sure those mixings are right, you know, with PLCs. I've done DCSs with boiler control, you know, I've done that too early on in my career.
What's your favorite industry to work in?
My favorite? I don't know if I have a favorite. You know, I love learning. So one of the things that I enjoy, and, you know, and early in my career when I worked for an engineering company, we didn't just focus on one particular industry. So I had to be diverse. So we had everything from food to, you know, pharmacy to petrochemical to, you know, whatever. So it was great, because I got to learn those businesses, you know, how they make. I know how to make jelly.
Wow.
You know, that kind of a thing. And so it was an interesting problem on what they were trying to solve there. But so you end up learning a very diverse type of, you know, experiences that help you apply later on. And so, you know, right now, you know, CSA Icon's, you know, historically been oil and gas, but we're getting out. We're trying to take that type of technology and experience to other industries as well. And, you know, that's one of the things that I bring, is some of the other industries that, you know, I have experience in. But I always love learning. And so anytime, you know, there's something new, I'm all over it. You know, I love different industries. And that's why I like the job that we do. We learn how things work.
Yeah.
And if you have that mentality, then you're going to love doing what you do.
Yeah.
So
that financial project that we were talking about sounds pretty interesting too, how it's like not really even an operational type of customer. So that's cool that, you know, you guys are broadening your horizon and reaching all levels of the enterprise across different industries.
Yeah, it gets to the point where, look, we're providing solutions, and whatever it takes for those solutions, you know, whether it's off the shelf, custom, you know, that, I mean, that's the ultimately what we're trying to do. We're trying to be partners for our customers and help them provide the best solutions for their problems.
Yeah.
You know. So here's a funny story. In fact, I just was at the OIT conference, oil and gas OIT conference last week, and I met an old buddy of mine that worked with me at the NASA facility. Okay,
wow.
So we started sharing stories that we forgot and all that. And you can Google this. Is that one time we had Taco Airlines land on our facility? Okay.
So, by accident or
no? What happened was they had an engine out, and they couldn't make it. This was in New Orleans, and they couldn't make it to the New Orleans airport. And Our facility, the facility of Mishu, is a facility that originally made World War II airplanes, and just over time it made different things. And so we literally had an old runway in the back that really nobody knew because grass was over it. And apparently the air traffic controllers knew about it. Well, because we make the external tank for the space shuttle, we're on the intercoastal canal. So there's a huge levee that goes around. So we put the tanks on the barges and they send them to the Cape.
Wow.
So me and a buddy of mine, we're working out at the wastewater treatment facility that's in the back, and we happen to be up high. I forgot what we were doing. And it was low cloud. All of a sudden, here comes this airline coming out of the sky. Wow. And we're like, it's going to hit us, which, you know, wasn't that close. But it ends up landing on that old runway. Now, that old runway was this deep below the ground, but he landed on it.
Wow.
His wing was very close to the levee. He landed back there. No one was hurt. The funny part was is the security leader didn't have protocol for what do you do when a plane lands in your backyard.
Yeah, doesn't happen every day.
So he panicked. So he said, no, that's it. No one's on the facility. So police were trying to get on. FAA was trying to get on. He's like, no, we're shut down. We're shut down mode. So these poor people, you know, they were from Guatemala, I think, or something. They didn't speak English. They hurried them in a, you know, they're scared. They just, you know, land.
Almost crash.
So. Crash, you know, and they put them in a conference room and all that. And so, you know, we're sitting there going, man, what in the world, you know? How are they going to get this thing out of here, whatever? And so finally, everything settles down, that kind of a thing. And so Boeing sends a test pilot to fly it out because we have this kind of a 4-lane road, believe it or not, in this facility. And wow. So he was going to take this plane jet off. And we're like, I got a runway. So they let us go out and watch. We can go as close as we want. It was no big deal. And we talked to the test pilot. And he goes, oh, there's nobody on board. I've got enough fuel. I just need to go there. You know, they fix the engine and whatever and take off. And then
wow.
Years later, I go to a conference, and it was the guys that are doing the land speed record for, you know, and they have Microsoft sponsoring and all. And I was talking, and this guy tells me he used to run the Boeing test pilot program. So I told him about Taka Airlines. He goes, oh, yeah, I'm the one that sent that pilot over there. And he knew all about it. And it was like a small, you know.
Interesting.
So the funny thing is the FAA gave that facility an award for the best safety record of any international airport. We only have one flight.
That's hilarious.
You know.
That's
so
cool.
Yeah, but no, I've done, you know, that job was a really great job to just learn how to engineer. And, you know, I had great mentors that you could fall back on, but they really wanted you to kind of learn on your own. I did everything from designed a video production studio there because they have to video all the inspections.
Oh, wow.
You know, so they had to do that. And then they have a closed circuit television. So the television's all over the facility so they can broadcast the launches and things like that. So I worked on that. And, you know, I've done heat treat ovens that were 500 kV electric ovens, you know.
Wow.
Doing the controls for those things. And so very slow system there. But
yeah. What... You talked about like mixing chemicals, or you talk about heat treatment. What are some of those process variables that are particularly difficult to like work with as far as like tuning, or I know like when you're doing chlorine injection, or you're trying to, you know.
Well, anytime you have a laggy system, meaning that, you know, what your sensors are reading is that there's a delay in that system, the laggy system, you're always going to have problems. It's going to be more difficult, right? And so it's been a while.
Why is that?
Well, if you think about it, you got a closed loop, and you're saying that, okay, if I open this valve, okay, you know, and so I'm expecting a change, but the change isn't immediate.
Right, because it's got to, like,
it's
mix.
It's slow.
Or
it's
the sensor's
slow.
Further down.
The sensor's further down, or it just so happens that I have just a slow-responding system to that input. Then you end up overshooting, because by the time you get the feedback, you've actually went too far.
Yeah.
You overshot, and then so you end up with a runaway. And there's different. It's been years since I've done this kind of stuff. We used to use what they call Smith protectors, where you can kind of predict what's going to happen to help with your loop.
Smith protector.
Smith predictors.
Predictors.
Yeah, okay. That's a thing. But you know, in the olden days, you kind of modeled, you modeled your system, and you got to kind of, you figured out exactly how to do that. And I'm not,
what your tuning parameters should be.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on PID control anymore.
Do you ever have to do some sort of linear step response type of system to kind of eliminate?
Yeah, you get in that. And one of the things that people, and one of the things I learned, I remember it was really, you remember things, one of the things that stick in your mind and what you remember, right, throughout your whole life is people say it's tied to emotion and that kind of a thing. And to me, it was a big aha moment, which is when you tune a loop, you tune it for two different things. You tune it for environmental change or whatever, but you also have set point change.
Yeah.
So I can have this great tuned loop that it doesn't respond. If I change the set point on it, it's not tuned at all.
Right.
And that was like a big aha. Oh, man, I never even thought about that. Because some characteristics of the system, and people can talk much better than I can about it. But I remember that, it's not response. It doesn't do well against set point change, but it can, once you're in steady state, it's fine.
Interesting.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. So then I've heard of like things like gain scheduling, like when you change a set point, that it somehow throws like another set of PID variables in until you
right
get...
right. So yeah, you can get very complicated in that, and that I'm not into that anymore.
Right.
I mean, and
so it seems like there should just be kind of a function block that just kind of does
exactly.
For you. But I guess there's too many variables of how you would actually want that to work in the real life.
It's funny you mentioned function blocks, because I worked a long time ago on more products had a DCS system, and the way you programmed it was with AutoCAD.
Interesting.
And you would have blocks.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know AutoCAD. You have AutoCAD blocks that represented, here's a PID controller, and here's, it's kind of like a fancy ladder logic in a sense.
Yeah.
But you're doing more analog control with this, and so I did that, as
very
well.
Cool. So, where do you think self-driving cars are going?
I think we'll get there. I think the worst part of time is this hybrid. I think self-driving cars are going to be great when that's the only thing that's out there.
Right.
It's when this mixture of humans and self-driving cars is what's going to be the problem. It's going to be a problem for a long time, and I just don't see how, that's going to work. I see it just causing, I think legislation is going to get involved and kill stuff that we want to do, but at the same time, they're going to be blamed for every accident, even though it's not there. It's just people resist change, right?
Like a human driving that same car would have
done worse or
right.
Whatever. And there's always the dilemma, right? The software has a decision. It's going to be in this accident. It has a choice. Does it kill the person riding the bicycle?
Yeah.
Or does it kill the occupant?
Right.
I mean, and then so someone has to make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
On how the software is going to react, right? And people don't like to think of things as being that simple of a cut and dry, right?
Yeah.
Even though when you're driving, you actually made like a decision as to if it's avoidable and I have to make a choice. But when a car has to make a choice as to essentially someone's going to die.
It's going
to
be deterministic.
It's got to decide something. It can't
right.
just say, flip a coin and do a random generator and
the
pick
program
something.
Halts and then they both die.
Yeah, exactly. and we're starting to see that. We're starting to see the guys fall asleep with the Teslas, and that kind of a thing. And so it's still, I have a car that does not have an autopilot, but it does do lane detection.
Mm.
Okay. And it purposely doesn't drive very well. It's like bumper cars. It will keep me in the lane, but it looks like I'm drunk. There's a boom, boom. It'll do that. And I know they're doing it on purpose.
That's interesting.
So that it's not on purpose. But, between that and then you have the adaptive cruise control.
Autopilot.
So you don't have to worry about stopping,
It's not full self-driving, but it's
not full, but it's enough to where you can see how people could abuse it.
Yeah.
And that type of thing. So, I think that it's amazing how much progress we've made. I mean, if you remember those DARPA challenges where people would go in this closed neighborhood and they'd run into everything?
Yeah.
It seems like, and then a year later now we've got, cars on the road doing well.
Yeah.
So, it's very interesting. Another thing is, I think you might find this interesting, is that since I like automation, my house is automated.
Okay, let's talk about that.
With MQTT.
Oh, nice.
So I use MQTT for all my events in my house. I use Node-RED.
Oh, sweet.
So I've gone through and used a lot of the other OpenHAB. I used Home Assistant, and I just got tired of them because of the every time you'd upgrade it, something breaks, and it's just the manageability of it. So I decided, hey, I'm doing MQTT. I'm going to do it at home.
Okay.
And so I've got just one Linux server that I built off some cheap hardware. Got a UPS on that sucker, so it ain't going to go. It ain't going to die anytime soon. And everything, all my events are MQTT, and I'll let Node-RED handle all the logic and that type of thing. So it works really well. In fact, on the way here, I got an alert saying one of my sensors' batteries was low.
Oh, very cool.
You know,
what sensors are you working with that support MQTT?
So I do mainly all my lighting control Z-Wave.
Okay.
And there's this fella, I forgot his name, that he had written a Z-Wave to MQTT adapter. Okay. That runs a service that runs. So what I do is I run that, and so now everything gets translated to MQTT, and then I use that, and so then I can log the events, I can do whatever I want with that. Then I have an alarm system. I just built my house, and when you build a house, everybody sticks some alarm company sticks their proprietary alarm system in there, right? Yeah. And it's all wired, yeah. Which I love. You know, anytime you can have a wired sensor, it's better than a wireless. Still reliable. So I bought a modem that connects up to it, that does USB, that fakes out to be a keypad. Mm. And so now I have tied that in, wrote a service that now does MQTT. So I can get an MQTT event for every window that's open, every door is open. I can arm the system. I can disarm the system. I then have it do alert. So I'm doing my own monitoring. It didn't cost me anything to do that. So
that's pretty sweet.
But you know, it's funny, as I have all this data that I'm collecting, and I don't know what to do with it. In other words, I have sensors, you know, doing lighting, motion, humidity, temperature, those type of things. I have some like little closed loops, like in my master bedroom, if the humidity gets too high, I turn on the exhaust fan, you know, those type of things. Okay. And some, you know, automatic light stuff that I want to do. But it's interesting because you can watch the sun, you know, go down, go up, and then if there's clouds, you can watch it. So I've got this data. What can I do with it? Yeah. And I've got lighting on all sides of my house, so I could infer something from that, you know, and have fun with that. But I'm collecting all this data. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. But it's been very reliable. I just moved in March, and the MQTT stuff is really easy to troubleshoot. You know, I've got this little, you know, I'm running Mosquito as the hub.
Okay.
And, you know,
why not use something like, as you know, coming from Microsoft on the IT world, why not use something like IoT Hub or something like?
But because I don't want to go cloud. I don't want the latency. And the dependency on my internet activity. My goal is to be, you know, you end up having a lag going through whatever service you know, IFTT is a very famous thing people use for doing logic and stuff like that, and you can see that lag.
Like you flip a switch and then it takes a second for the API call to go. And
right, it has to go to the cloud. There's just more steps, right? And then if you're, you know, you lose your internet, then
your whole home goes down.
Yeah, exactly. So there's some advantages, and then we see that same correlation with the edge. Analytics on the edge, you know, it's kind of the same thing. We're not seeing closed loop control over through the cloud,
right?
You know that, right. You know that's, you know, that latency that is not deterministic. Plus, it's not as reliable. I don't care what anybody says. Your internet connection is not 100% reliable, right? So if I don't need to use the cloud, I don't. I mean, I use for voice. I still use like Alexa. Services for that, you know, for all my voice interaction. And yes, that goes to the cloud to process.
But then you send it back down to
it controls
Linux server.
It actually goes to the Node-RED.
Oh, okay.
Node-RED can fake a Hue device. Okay, and so since Alexa talks natively, so I do a proper node and call it lamp whatever, and now the Echo device recognizes that, and I can turn it on and off with voice.
Okay.
Plus, it has routines now. So you can say whatever you can say. If I say this, then turn this device on, and that triggers my automation in my Node-RED. So
you're bringing up a point that I haven't really touched on too much in the documentary is when are we going to start seeing voice control being more prevalent in industry?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things that I've seen a lot of industries struggle with, in a sense that where is the voice applicable?
It's like not even
Talked about.
I think it's not really talked about from the sense of, like, you know, no one's really pushing a lot of industry voice products, right? Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot of ML and AI and VR, AR demos and products from, you know, all the big automation companies and small automation companies too, but we're not seeing, like, Alexa for your plant.
Yeah, I guess if you're an operator, you know, do you want to sit there and do you feel comfortable just talking to it versus just hitting a button? You know, I think in some respects things are faster.
You definitely want to have both, though.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, you can. You can augment it. You know? You know, to take the flip side of that, I got a funny story, is that I had a client that was using radio for their transmission, and they were using it on the same bands that their audio was. So what the operators were doing, they were listening to the actual traffic modem noises. And they would know when something's wrong based on all the tones, and they got used to it. So when they switched over to different radios, they were all mad because they would be driving around in the field and just had the radio on, and they heard, oh, I hear that noise. Oh, that means this is down. So they learned, because a human's very good at picking pattern out detection. Patterns like that. And so they used the audio to help them understand what was going on. You know?
Interesting. Yeah, I think that could be cool, though. Like, not only for control, I think, you know, control might be even a, you know, something that maybe have some sort of confirmation, but for querying, like, you know, what is our production today, or what was our production
and
yesterday?
And that's some of the things that I toyed with before coming to ICON, was that the executive dashboard where that was voice activated, you know, which is ask me this, ask me that, and it would just tell you, and you wouldn't have to get up. And to me, voice is used for doing things that, while you're multitasking, where I don't want to pick up a computer, I want to do that. I just want to talk, that kind of a thing. Yeah. So, I do it so that it makes it easier for my wife. But, you know, she just tell Alexa goodnight, and she shuts the house down, sets the alarms, turns the TV off.
Oh, very cool.
You know, that kind of a thing. And then, or you can tell her good morning, and she'll turn the lights on that you want, you know, and that kind of a thing. Turn your TV on for you, whatever.
Give you your flash briefing.
Yeah, give you, exactly, because it's a routine, so I can do all that. Give you your flash briefing.
Zach Scriven podcast flash briefing, Alexa skill.
Well, you can add it.
Yeah.
You know, you can add it as an option, but...
And then that and TikTok are next on my list of things I want to start doing.
TikTok?
Yeah, unfortunately. It's like I don't want to, but I know I kind of
have to. You have to, yeah.
It's one of those things.
Yeah. But no, it's very interesting. You know, I can look at, since I have humidity in my master bath, I can see, like, when I take a shower, you know.
Oh, interesting.
You know, that kind of a thing. Or when I get up in the middle of the night to use the bathroom, you know, I can see that event, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it's you know, it's interesting from that standpoint. And then right now cameras are completely I don't have wireless cameras, they're all wired just from a prior, you know.
Right.
But I do have firewall, I do have VLANs. Right. I am kind of anal from that
you
standpoint.
Are the,
yeah,
the I'm tech, like classical tech nerd.
Yeah, I'm that nerd, you know, guy. And so
I wanted to touch back on Industry 4.0.
Sure.
What are, like, you know, I've heard a lot of answers about, you know, it's a democratization of data. And, like, what are some of those other concepts that you've seen play into it? Like, not just data or machine learning, but what are those other things out there that are part of that, you know, next digital factory or that industrial revolution?
You know, I see things that, that are, you know, you hear of IoT and IIoT, industrial IoT, and some of the things that come to my mind are what I consider industrial IoT or IoT things. And I see that some of those could translate. Like, for instance, crowd control, crowd monitoring where people are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's some ever, you know, in a past life I did some work with that. But you can see that from a factory standpoint, from a safety standpoint. So a lot of people don't talk about, say, you know, how is this doing for safety, right?
Oh.
So if I could know where all my people are.
Or forklifts and trucks.
Or just all over.
Everything.
Imagine a huge plant and having where everybody's out, sort of, for emergency situations. Did everybody go, you know, did they follow the right procedures? Is everybody out? Is there anybody there? You know, presence detection, that kind of stuff. I mean, you're seeing it with mining, right? They track people with mining and things like that, where they are. But just having that presence, you know, everywhere.
So kind of maybe almost like biotechnology, like wearables or...
Right, yeah, exactly.
Ideally, this is something I can leave at the office and go home and not have inside of my body, but...
Yeah, exactly.
Like maybe
exactly.
My phone would
phone
be cool.
Phone or something, yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if you're in a hard hat environment, you could have something on your hard hat.
Oh, that'd be cool.
You know, something
smart
like...
Smart hard hats.
Smart hard hats, you know, and so you know where your people are at any given time. So when there's an emergency...
Mm-hmm. With the real wear, or like they have that AR... And
right,
those are
exactly.
Integrated directly
yeah,
in the hard
I have
hat.
A friend in town that's doing some AR work for a big client, and they're trying to do it for maintenance, where you know you can pull up the manual, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
I think AR is gonna be adopted sooner than VR, just because computationally it's a lot less complex to just augment our existing world than to create a new one. But then also, even more so than maybe voice as well too. But I think AR is right there.
I think AR has got a lot more use cases too. Yeah. If you really think about it, that are, like you said,
maintenance.
It's low hanging fruit from that standpoint. From a technology standpoint, it's mm-hmm. a little much easier, like you said, to pull off. But you know, like anything else, it's like.
Are you working with any products or softwares that have that AR functionality, or
I'm not personally. Yeah.
Okay.
I haven't seen that yet. I think that's it's interesting to see the ROI on something like that.
Yeah.
A lot of people that can afford to play around with the experiment to see and discover what the possibilities are. That's great.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where you're even seeing that in the drilling space. Right, just drillers looking into automation of the drilling platforms and the AR stuff like that, so they can.
That was one thing I actually talked about, and maybe you want to touch on, is like the integration of data, but from all life cycle, not only like all life cycles of a well, but mm-hmm. also like from the entire value stream, of the oil, and somehow gaining insight like. From data collected during the drilling process to the operational process to, then also the flow of oil downstream and...
It's going to take...
Even across different companies.
Yeah, and that's the thing you're going to have, right? Because usually, you'll have... unless you're the majors, you're going to have the custody is going to change over once they get the.
But there still would be value in sharing that data.
Yeah, I don't know
for track and trace or for
exactly, and so because you're seeing that, what if you're in production, what are you trying to do? You're trying to lower your cost, operating cost. You're trying to improve safety, and you try to produce as much as you can.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah.
And so if you can talk to a client that can address one of those three,
say those three again?
So you're going to reduce your cost
right.
of operations, okay? Improve safety,
okay,
right? Or produce more revenue,
right?
Increase yield produce something out of the ground.
Of the well.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're starting to see a lot of companies pop up trying to use ML to try to get more barrels out of the ground a day.
So that was one... Two themes and two additional themes of Industry 4.0 is vertical integration.
Mm-hmm.
And, you have some of the companies, oil and gas players, that do vertically integrate themselves, which then it obviously makes sense that they're going to share data internally
mm-hmm.
from that whole entire value stream. But then also horizontal integration, either from companies merging, but also like from a standpoint of if I was a drilling company and there's a dozen other drilling companies, maybe there's a way that I can monetize or lease my data to help other drilling companies who might even be considered my competitors, but that collectively, if we share that data, then we can all improve and essentially drive more value to
right.
who we're
yeah.
actually drilling the
right.
wells for.
Right.
So in turn,
yeah,
are you seeing anything like that?
I personally haven't. I've seen the opposite where there's secret wells, and I don't understand why that is the case, where certain wells no one can know that they exist and things like that. And I don't know enough about what's the competitive influence and how competition really impacts that and what they're willing to share.
Because this same concept is also very true for I think it's actually more prevalent in OEMs.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a palletizer, let's say, and I have shipping that palletizer to Amazon and Walmart and Coca-Cola,
right.
and naturally I'm going to be collecting that data from all my clients
right.
if I'm using IoT
mm-hmm.
and then using that to make my palletizers
mm-hmm.
more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be kind of an example of a horizontal integration. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see more companies doing more collaboration.
And I think if it's not a competitive edge, if it's just like, I had a client that makes automotive paint, and the vessels they use to transport those paint are really great for making meth. So they wanted a way, because they're getting stolen. And said they wanted to know if there's a possibility they can put trackers on those things to track the thing. So let's say they solve that problem. They don't have a problem with sharing it with other companies. It's not like they're going to, you know what I mean? And so those type of things.
Why is it that we want to monetize a competitive edge and not just share it? So everyone,
it's
a selfish gene.
It also could be just, you know, the mentality or the age of the management. You know what I mean?
Because for me, you think it's more of like a new generation, like kind of more of that internet type of mentality where, I mean, obviously you need to stay in business and stuff. And I think, you know, certain things need to be patented to make the development necessary. Right. But I think, you know, I'm definitely leaning more towards open source and sharing. And, you know, now we can solve better problems rather than trying to squeeze every last penny out of.
When if you go to trade shows, you see competitors getting up there sharing their ideas and stuff. I just think that a lot, especially the only guys, they're afraid to share their data, much less put it in the cloud.
Because then tomorrow they're going to have to go do something new then, too.
So, but the cloud, you know, and the margins are being squeezed in this industry, you know, and so, you know,
Integration or in
just in general, just everything's you know, the price of oil is going down, so your margin's going so it's forcing the industry to get more efficient, which they are, which is great. You know, that usually happens in the industry, you know, so they can reduce their overall costs and increase their production. I mean, that's where fracking is only profitable because of the when the price gets to a certain point, you just can't frack, it's just cost prohibitive, right? And so you get to see that. So I think the industry is you're starting to see them think a lot, you know, quote smarter, being more about efficiency and stuff, so that they can reduce that cost to produce that, get that oil, that barrel out of the ground, right?
Yeah.
And find it right too. So exploration, you know. So
where's the future of the oil industry?
Oh man, it's great.
Domestic?
Yeah, I don't know. I hear things, and I think domestic, I used to know some buyers for some other companies, and they used to tell me things, but I can't tell you. But, you know, we have oil. You know, we don't need international oil. I mean, I think, and so what
especially here in Texas.
Well, no, but I mean, just in general, I think that there a lot of it, you know how it is, everything's political.
Right.
But
isn't it like recently we've now become an exporter of oil? Or
I think so. I think like I heard that.
Net positive producer. Right.
And then you look at natural gas, you know, with some of the recent, we have plenty of natural gas now, you know, but then we're seeing in Texas, we have so much solar, you know.
So, but you're not seeing a huge, like, scare within the industry as far as like electric vehicles and kind of getting less dependent on oil?
No, I mean, I think you're starting to see like the majors very diversify, right? So I have a battery operated lawnmower.
Right, like plastics and polymers.
I have a battery operated lawnmower that is owned by Chevron, I think.
Interesting.
Okay. Owns the company, right? You know,
just as long as they're not owning it to then shut it down like the EV1.
Right. But I love this battery operated lawnmower. Cool. You know, it's good batteries. Put it in there. You know, it's quiet, whatever. But I looked at it, and the parent company is Chevron. So you know, hey,
that's cool.
Yeah, you know, and so
they're seeing that things are heading that direction.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so, but it's not going to happen overnight.
Right,
I mean, and that's the other thing. People don't understand that oil, it doesn't all get converted to gasoline.
Right, there's roads.
There's plastic. There's a lot of, petroleum products out there.
Also, like, certain things like space travel can't go electric. You need some sort of...
Yeah.